Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Cancer is the leading cause of death in Latinos, but for many forms of cancer, Latinos actually have fewer instances, but Latinos face higher risk for certain cancers, such as stomach and liver cancers, compared to whites. This stems from cultural barriers to care, low screening rates, underrepresentation in clinical studies, and data that fails to reflect the diversity within the U.S. Latino population. So what can be done to reduce the number of cancer deaths in the Latino population? That's our topic for this hour, and we invite you to call in with your questions and comments. The number is 210-614-8980. Have you had cancer? Has it touched you or your family? If you're Latino, do you feel like there were barriers to finding treatment or maybe not getting screened early enough, and that may have led to a more complicated trip through cancer? Call us. Number is 210-614-8980. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at @tprsource. We're joined this hour by Amalie Ramirez, a doctor of public health, professor in the chair of the Department of Population Health Sciences, and the director of the Institute for Health Promotion Research at UT Health San Antonio, and co-editor of the book Advancing the Science of Cancer in Latinos. Amalie, welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much.
Also with us on the phone, we're joined by Julia Maas, a patient and advocate, is a cancer survivor, and can talk about how she has felt that there has been barriers as a Latina to receive cancer treatment. And Julia, you're there. Welcome to The Source.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
And with us in the studio, we're joined by Dr. Katie Lathrop, a assistant professor of hematology oncology at UT Health San Antonio, a care provider in the breast cancer program at the Mays Cancer Center. And Kate, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And so there is a conference coming up. It's in February 26th through 28th that looks at this issue. It is open to the public. Registration is available, and it's at downtown at the Plaza Marriott. And Amalie Ramirez, can you talk about, so you had a conference before, it led to this big book that we have here that we'll get through, and yet another follow-up conference. Why are you, what questions are you asking?
Well, as you well know, I mean, many people don't know that the Hispanic population or Latino population in the United States is growing, and we are the majority minority population now in the United States, but very few studies have really been focused on the Latino population. You see more about the African American community in comparison to non-Hispanic whites type studies. And so we're really trying to say we need to do more research in this community that is growing by leaps and bounds.
And Dr. Kate Lathrop, tell me more from the doctor point of view, the science point of view, what needs to be observed? What needs to be teased out?
Sure. So we advance our therapies based on clinical trial evidence. So what we learn on clinical trials really affects what we do every day in the clinic and the treatments that we choose for our patients. Because I'm a breast cancer physician and I treat women with breast cancer, but my colleagues treat all different types of cancers. And this is how we all formulate individualized treatment plans for our patients. We can only treat the patients best if those patients are included on those trials. So if we have clinical trials that mainly represent people of a European white heritage, then patients that are of different heritage, like Hispanics or African Americans, we don't know if they'll respond in the same fashion. Drugs aren't necessarily metabolized the same way in every different ethnic group. Sometimes they are, but sometimes there's important differences. And there can be important differences in side effects or toxicities to drugs, not only with ethnicity, but also with age. And so the more diverse our clinical trials can be, the better we know that they will work in our patient population that we're treating.
So these drugs, they're very precise and they're very complex, and they react to different people differently. And we don't know whether or not ethnicity, whatever that is, because it's very complex in this area, and we'll get to that. And so whether or not it's actually going to reduce the cancer or affect the cancer, it's one issue. The other part of it is what's it going to do to the patient themselves, and whether or not how they process that. And so and we can't use anecdotal information, because that is really the worst way to go when trying to figure out how to beat cancer, because it's got to be done in a scientific manner.
Right. You make some good points there. So you can't just say that one person's experience is going to translate to a larger group. And that's why most of our trials, particularly in breast oncology, we will enroll thousands of women onto a clinical trial for drugs that are right at the phase where they're about to be FDA approved. And if we don't have that diversity within the population, if I have a woman of Latino background in my clinic, but everybody on the trial was predominantly white, I may not know how that drug is going to affect her from side effect profile or from efficacy, how well the drug works. And there are specific examples where they've taken women who are of African American descent and looked at large databases, and they can see that certain medicines that we use routinely for breast cancer do not work as well for those women. And we don't know if that's because they have more side effects and they're not able to tolerate, and therefore they don't have the same dosing level as other women. Or it could be that from a biologic standpoint, that drug level isn't high enough, or it's metabolized or processed in the body differently. So if we don't have enough representation, we don't know. And that not knowing is just not acceptable.
Julia Maas, you're a patient advocate. What are you advocating? Tell me, what is your pitch?
I have a few. But I'd say my main one is the importance of the inclusion of the patients at every step of the way. So a lot of the problems mentioned earlier of not minorities not being included in trials at the same rate, or even the overall participation in clinical trials for cancer patients is too low, even if you include the Caucasian patients. So in order to get trials that include more patients and to get patients to understand the importance of participating in trials, patients need to be involved all along the way. You can't come to us at the very end and be, here's this great thing that I set up for you. You should participate in it. Patients should be included from the very beginning. When the scientists who don't see patients are having ideas of what they're going to study, they should be talking with the people whose lives are going to be impacted by that research.
So as we talk about dealing with cancer in Latinos, there's all these different phases that we have to consider. One of them, of course, would be like prevention, doing what we can to reduce cancer risk in specific populations. The other one is early detection and screening. How available is a screening for certain populations? Because we're seeing in Latino cancer patients that more turn up with cancer further developed. It's late stage cancer, and which is why cancer tends to be more fatal for this population, even though they may have reduced cancer rates. And then it's culturally sensitive treatment and helping people become cancer survivors. And we know that there's a lot of mental fortitude that has to go into that as well, and how do we tap into that for this specific population and culture. So there's a lot to talk about, and our phone lines are open, and we really want to hear from our community on this. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this. You're You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about cancer research in the Latino population. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. Has cancer impacted your family, your Latino family here in San Antonio? And did you see that there were some barriers maybe to early detection or even to treatment or having doctors being able to communicate what was happening with your loved one or even to you? Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. John is on the line. And John, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
All right, John, go right ahead.
The point I wanted to bring up, I was diagnosed last year with testicular cancer. I'm son of Cuban parents and grew up in the New York area. I'm in a low-income household. And it turns out that my testicular cancer could be directly related to trauma to the groin area. And...
All right. Well, we lost that call. And so let me go to Dr. Katie Lathrop to address that.
Yeah, thanks for your call. Interestingly, we just looked at our data for testicular patients at our cancer center. And there's some other studies that showed that Hispanic men with testicular cancer, their outcomes are worse than non-Hispanic whites. And at our cancer center, we actually found that our outcomes were equal to those of non-Hispanic whites. But we did find, importantly, that men tend to present at an earlier age than non-Hispanic whites. So that represents a potential education platform where we can go to the community and say, this can happen, and it can happen at an earlier age. And so that people are more aware of that if they have a symptom or an abnormality, that they don't wait, that they know that that can really happen in their population. But I think it's also important, and we've seen this also in our breast patients, that women treated for breast cancer, men treated for testicular cancer in our community, they do well. And I think it really stems from us being, as Dr. Ramirez point out, a majority minority city. So we are taking care of Hispanic patients within that culture. And we have a system that hopefully they feel comfortable presenting for screening and coming into the clinics. Things like help with transportation, help with establishing funding, providers who speak Spanish, navigators who speak Spanish, things that really can help open the doors where we can make an impact compared to other places in the United States.
This point that the caller had about being told that he had this, his late diagnosis was related to this Latino mindset that he should just walk it off, get over it, something that you may see sort of this machismo attitude about dealing with pain. And Julia Miles, you're a patient advocate. Is there a way that we should be really talking about this, shouldn't we?
I agree. We should be talking about cancer. There's a lot of stigma, and I would also add, in breast cancer, which is the cancer I have, men get breast cancer too. So that's an even higher level of stigma, where men often have breast cancer and say that they have some sort of chest cancer, and that's all associated with the stigma that people experience, or people with lung cancer are worried about getting told that they smoked and they caused that on them. It's very sad that oftentimes it comes to the reality that these people are going to experience this emotional abuse after the fact that they have to live with this disease.
So this is a way that it's not talking about two individuals. We need to be talking to communities about encouraging others to seek treatment. And Amelie Ramirez, as you know, in your research as at the Department of Population Health Sciences and director of the Institute for Health Promotion Research at UT Health San Antonio, how are you going about trying to change the mindset of a community, telling people, to take cancer seriously?
We're actually going out into the community and have developed these educational programs so that we can do some small group education. What we're finding is that there's a lot of fear in the Latino community about cancer, and so we're trying to reduce that fear and to educate the community that the importance of coming in early and, you know, knowing the signs and symptoms for different types of cancer. And then also in South Texas, we're using a telemedicine approach to get our information all the way out, you know, to the tip of Brownsville. So here we're doing kind of a small group settings and going into high-risk zip code areas and educating and working with different community partners to get this information across. But it's available in English and Spanish. It's available so that they can have one-on-one opportunity to talk to our community health workers about some concerns that they have. And then, as Dr. Lampther mentioned, you know, connecting them to our cancer center through a patient navigator if they're concerned that they don't have health insurance or that they're not sure how they can pay for the screening, we help facilitate that.
Julia Maas, I know that you're a cancer survivor. Do you want to tell us about your experience?
Sure. So I have metastatic breast cancer. So I was diagnosed when I was pregnant at 29 years old. We thought I had early stage breast cancer at first. And we couldn't do scans of the rest of my body because I was expecting a baby. So I received the standard of care during the pregnancy, which surprisingly to me was chemotherapy. So I wasn't drinking coffee, but I was told that I was going to be given chemotherapy. And of course, the biggest concern was how that was going to affect my son. I finished the four courses of treatment. He was born healthy and full of hair, and I was completely bald. He was doing well and healthy, and I could do scans that I couldn't do while pregnant. And that's when we found that my cancer had spread to my bones, liver, and brain. He is now 6.5 years old, and I'm stable on treatment, and I have chemotherapy every 3 weeks. I have excellent medical care. I have learned to advocate for myself and later on started advocating for others living with this disease and for people with cancer in general. I think this could be even broader than cancer, so all research and all work on policy and that affects people living with certain illness needs to be in touch and in tune with the people ultimately benefiting from those treatments, from those policies. So I have found that to be very important for me as I navigate the rest of my life with cancer, because I will always have cancer. Hopefully it will be at bay and controlled.
Julia, you are Brazilian, and has that played a role in this?
That's right. So I'm originally from Brazil. It has played a role, mostly because English is not my first language. Although this year I will have spent more of my life in the United States than in Brazil. So this really is home for me, and I went to college and worked in the United States. My whole adult life has been here. I also would like to bring up the fact that I look like my German mother rather than my native South American father. So I'm very aware of the privilege that I experience from looking Caucasian and often being mistaken by just a white American woman.
How do we know that would be different if she presented, you know, more moreno, morena? Julia, why do you think that gave you some sort of there was some sort of implicit bias out there that has helped you?
I mean, I'll let the doctor talk more about the data on this, but I know for a fact that having doctors that look like you have an impact on people's outcomes. there are a number of, so there's not enough representation in the staff that works with the patients that look like them. There's, of course, the trust issue. I'm not too familiar with the history of the Hispanic participation in clinical trials, but for African Americans, they're very, very traumatizing stories with Henrietta Lacks and the Tuskegee, and it's difficult for people to believe that it is in their best interest to participate in trials. And oftentimes patients have that perception that they don't want to be the guinea pig when they're participating in a trial. I think in general, one of the things that I do when I speak with patients is it's very rare for an oncology trial. I have actually never come across one to have a complete placebo unless the standard of care is to not treat something. So that whole understanding of getting the sugar pill and not getting any drug and being in worse health after the clinical trial, that is not how trials in the United States are done. But it's not, this information doesn't get out there to the patients and the community enough.
Amelie Ramirez, as there's this trust issue that she's bringing up, how are we trying to build that trust?
Well, for us, it's very important that our community outreach workers are bilingual, that are from the community, so that they've identified with the individuals, they know the resources, they partner very closely with our clinicians at the cancer center so that we can also, work with our social workers and so forth to help make sure that that transition and getting in the care that they need is really smooth. So we really work very, very hard at that. We make ourselves available, for the individuals to call us if they have any questions. And most of all, again, we partner with community organizations, churches, and different groups that that know about our work and can also support the initiatives that we've been working on.
Is there data that supports the suspicion that Latinos are going to receive substandard care of cancer?
There's concerns out there because they come in so late, and that's kind of the myths and misconceptions that are out there. And so that's why we do these research studies to not only increase education, but make sure that they're getting into the types of trials that are going to be effective for them. For example, with cervical cancer right now, no woman should die from cervical cancer. We have the treatment available. We have a vaccine available, but part of it is the education and getting people in. So it's that has been a barrier, and or if they don't have health insurance, they tend to stay away.
And they have the HPV vaccine. That's correct. What we're talking about. Correct. And it's something that we're trying to encourage because there's no law that requires it, so that young men and young women are both vaccinated for this, because it's not just something that targets one gender over the other, but there tends to be a cultural barrier. So because it's like, well, I don't want to have a sexually promiscuous child or whatever, right?
Right. Actually, it's both ways. It's both that's the feeling of some of our population groups who haven't received the education, but we're also finding that sometimes our providers are having a difficult time in offering the vaccine to the family member, and so that we're also trying to get the physicians to be more proactive in offering it to the family and say, we think this is the right thing to do.
So you want the doctors to be more, hey, why don't you do this? This would be a really good idea. This could save your child's life from a terrible, terrible cancer.
That's correct. Yeah. So it's a two-part. Sometimes families don't want it, but then we're also trying to educate the providers that they can be more proactive about this.
All right, we got to take another break. Our phone lines are open. We're talking about cancer research in Latinos, not just talking about the medical part of it, but also the sociological part of it. How do we get more people to get into early screening? How do we talk more about trying to deal with the risk factors and also about the science? We'll talk more about that when we come back as well. The number is 210 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. We'll be right back. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about cancer research in Latinos. How do we reduce the death rate for the Latino community with cancer? And it's a complicated question. It's really going to take a community's response. Everyone, every family is going to have to kind of like incorporate this into their dining room tabletop conversation about how do we become aware of this, about this in our household, and how are we going to watch out for each other and encourage each other to get screened and to reduce our individual risk of cancer. How can you do this in your home? Have you seen cancer in your home? Do you think that being a Latino family presented barriers that should not have been there? How can we knock them down? Call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. So we've been talking to Julia Maas, and she's a patient advocate, and she is dealing with breast cancer, and she's a breast cancer survivor, and she's got this wonderful child, and it's a story that really makes you think. But her saying that she's a patient advocate, I mean, do we have enough Latinas or Latinos out there who say, I'm a patient advocate, and what, and how do you become one, a patient advocate? Kate Lathrop?
Yeah, I think we can never have enough patient advocates is the simple answer to that. And I think Julia has brought up multiple really good points over the last 30 minutes or so. No matter who the physician or the healthcare provider is, they can never associate with every one of their patients on every level. And so I think it's critical to have people in the community that can do that, whether it's Hispanic, whether it's African American, whether it's people of Asian descent as well. If you have those people helping bridge between the patients and the physicians, it helps a lot. And so we can never have enough advocates. The other point that Julia brought up that I think should be highlighted maybe again is their involvement in designing clinical trials. So we have advocates that help us design clinical trials. And for some trials, it's required that you must have advocates on the board during the design process of that trial so that the patient's voice is being heard during that process. And so those issues are really important. And the advocates I work with, I see the same ones often because we really don't have enough of them to go around. There are groups in San Antonio that do good work in training advocates. As a breast oncologist, I know the breast advocates, the San Antonio Breast Cancer Foundation has a big effort to train them, as does Komen, and I'm sure there's other groups and other tumor types that do that as well.
So let me talk to Amelie Ramirez. She's a doctor of public health. And how can, if someone is a cancer survivor and says, I want to be a patient advocate, what do they do?
Yeah, I would get in touch with their Komen chapter here in San Antonio and said, I'm interested in becoming an advocate, and also our cancer center, because we want these individuals, these cancer survivors, to be on our research studies, you know, so they can find out what studies we have available and how can they help. I think it's really critical. Or also the Alamo Breast Cancer Foundation is another organization. And these are, it's learning about the science of cancer. It's learning about how they can be involved, so they learn about how a trial is designed and so forth. So they really become a research member of the team by going through some of these training programs.
We have this conference coming up. It's going to be on February 26th through the 28th here in San Antonio at the Plaza Marriott. Is this someplace where a person who's interested, not really sure, is this right for me? If I go to this conference, I might have a better idea if this is where my passion lies.
Yes, we have a whole session on patient advocates. We have representatives from Puerto Rico coming. Our own Sandy is going to be a part of the session, the panel as well, to talk about what their work is and how they get involved.
So let's tackle the big elephant in the room here when we talk about Latinos and breast cancer or cancer in general. Latino is a big, broad term. And are we just talking about American Latinos, people who live in the United States? Is this all global Latinos? We have Julia. She's from Brazil. That's a Iberian Peninsula Portuguese. Is that really, not Spanish? Latino tends to be, someone who has some indigenous in them and some from the conquest, some European and maybe some African from the slave trade. There's a lot going on there. How do you tease out what you're talking about in a scientific way when you talk about Latinos?
Well, David, back in 1992, I had the first research study looking at similarities and differences among Latino groups. And I had representation from Miami representing Cuban Americans, in New York, Puerto Ricans, in San Francisco, Central and South Americans, and then looking at urban and border Latinos, Mexican Americans. Because of just what you've said, we go anywhere from the European to Native American, and I just today was visiting with a woman who's interested in more the Caribbean, Latinos. And all of these, we have different ancestries. And this is important because we don't know if there are certain aspects of things that we were exposed to in our different regions that are contributing to the different types of cancers that we have. And right now, we know more about certain types of cancers that impact African Americans or Asian populations, but less about Latinos. And we represent now 16% of the U.S. population, and we are the majority minority. But again, we don't know. We can't break it out. We have more data on Mexican Americans than we do in some of these other population groups that represent the whole heterogeneity of Latinos.
Even among Mexican Americans, there's subgroups, and it's hard to break that down. So, Dr. Kate Lathrop, when you look at that, I mean, there's genetics, there's environment, there's lifestyle, and how are they going to contribute towards cancer prevention, cancer treatment? How do you look at that?
Yeah, it's not an easy answer. There's not one answer to this. It's quite complicated, as Dr. Ramirez laid out. And right now, in a lot of our trials, people are self-reported. So we ask them what their ethnicity is, and they get to choose. That's the best way and the easiest way to do it right now. As we move towards more genomic, our DNA-based treatments for cancers in general, some of this will start to sort itself out, I think, over the next potentially 5 to 10 years, but it's going to take a long time. And I'd like to use one specific example in detecting women who have a mutation for breast cancer, which is called BRCA, BRCA1 and BRCA2, which many people may have heard about in the media. The databases for coming up with who should be screened for a mutation have not included large numbers of Hispanic patients. And we know that there's different types of mutations that affect the BRCA gene. And for Hispanic women who are underrepresented in that database, there may be mutations that are actually dangerous mutations, but we don't know that yet because the numbers are too small. So again, it gets down to the number of people participating in the trials. So yes, there's extreme diversity within the Hispanic population, but if enough of those patients enroll in the trials, the diversity becomes a little bit less relevant because the numbers are there. And if the drugs work in that patient population, then we can apply it broadly outside of that population. So the key is to get the diversity onto the trial in the first place.
Right. Julia Maas, as a patient advocate and as a cancer survivor and from Brazil, what does this question mean to you?
I think in general that's another time where patients need to be involved. People need to talk about their history and their family. And I have people in my family that have had cancer, am I talking to those aunts? Am I asking the questions? Because all of that matters for my health right now. And it's really the destigmatizing cancer in general. A lot of times I think the stigma that comes with cancer is related to this general perception and also the use of the word prevention. People still feel at fault when they're diagnosed with cancer. Should I have done something different? Should I have gone and gotten a test earlier? And there's always something you can find. But the language we use around cancer doesn't help. So when we say that exercise prevents cancer, that makes someone that doesn't exercise as much as they think they should think that they were at fault for getting a cancer diagnosis, when the correct language should have been exercise reduces the risk of cancer. But even someone that exercises every day, eats healthy their whole life, they can be hit by that lightning and they can be diagnosed with cancer too. So I think we don't talk enough about the fact that cancers happen, and we need to remove the blame from the patient and just move forward with the science.
And so we're coming up on a break. It's astonishing, though. We've made tremendous breakthroughs, but still so many limitations in trying to establish what the genetics are for cancer and who is at risk, and trying to come up with a linkage directly between of an ethnic label, which basically is kind of a sociological construct, and put that into medical terms, it just doesn't work. And so that needs to be clarified. But also the issues that we do have with the barriers based upon that social construct are real. And that needs to be deconstructed and figure out how do we help people who label themselves as Latino or Hispanics or Mexican Americans to have better access to health care so that they can deal with the risk. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about cancer research in the Latino population, what is out there, what needs to be done. We certainly need to recognize that cancer is the leading cause of death in Latinos, and we see the rates will be going up in the near future. What can be done to reduce the cancer deaths in the Latino population? The number is 210-614-8980. Let's go to the callers, and this is Lily. Hi, Lily. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Mr. Davis, I'm sorry. I want to say it's not exactly on the topic, but I resent commercialization of cancer. I resent seeing ads on TV about cancer centers. I resent cancer drugs. I'm a cancer survivor myself. And it's been like 24, I got my cancer in 1997. And at that time, there were no commercials. There were no cancer centers going against each other or something. To me, this raises the cost.
Right.
And it's, this way actually I cannot trust the doctors because I think maybe they're on take.
Okay.
And they want to, those places, they want to promote their treatments and stuff like that. I know in Canada, I know in Britain, they don't have ads on these kinds, especially cancer.
All right. Lily, thank you so much for calling in, and you bring up a couple of interesting and important points. Julia Maz, you're in Brazil. You're from Brazil. You understand how things work there and the American medical system, too, and you've been in both, I imagine, two very different systems.
Yes.
I have gone back and forth on the issue of having commercials for drugs on TV. I do want to say, as a patient, as a person living with metastatic breast cancer, which is the breast cancer that has left the breast and that is the terminal stage of breast cancer, there has been a lot more awareness about this illness and about the fact that breast cancer is a deadly disease. It is not a pink celebration. And in general, people have become more aware about MBC due to commercials that have been on TV. Now, I completely understand the point of pricing, and I agree that the pricing on the drugs is absolutely unsustainable, and the fact that they're paying commercials to be played on TV during the Super Bowl definitely has played a role in the price of these drugs.
So as we talk about early detection and helping people find out if they have signs of cancer before the tumors grow and becomes more complicated, and trying to having access to health care and screening, that's very important. And that's something that people who have health insurance are maybe easier to access than others. You know, you don't want to show up when the cancer is just beyond treatment. And so, Amelie Ramirez, can you talk about, you know, if we have, I say, like a universal coverage plan, whatever that looks like, would you think this is a way to help people get more treatment?
Well, again, right now we're finding that people, even with health insurance, they're not coming in for their yearly checkups. And that's covered, at least for cervical, breast, and colon. It's covered, you know, and so they should come in on a yearly basis. So we need to do a better job. They need to understand why they're not, understand why they don't want to come in. And again, we go back to this whole issue of fear. But if we can get something identified early, you know, the treatments are much better. Your options are much greater for you. So it's something that we all have to work on and encourage folks to utilize that benefit that they have. You know, even if there is a small copay along with it, it's just really important to get in early. But those are the three major cancers that we can screen for ahead of time, would be colon, cervical, and breast cancer screening.
And these are the cancers that tend to show up very much in Latino population.
Well, actually, breast cancer is a little lower in the Hispanic population, but cervical cancer is higher, and colon cancer, where just new studies are showing that we're seeing it at an earlier age. You know, screening doesn't really begin until 50, but we're showing diagnosis at 40. And we think that there's an increase of obesity is really bringing these different types of cancers at an early stage. So individuals need to be really proactive about getting screened and asking their doctor. But also, if they have a family history, and Julia, you raised an important point, so important to know your family history, because again, in the Latino community, there was a fear, if I tell them I had cancer, I might pass it on. And it's not about passing it on. It's about letting them know so that they can be more proactive about getting screened. So share your family history with your family.
So in this book that you all put together, and it's interesting, but it's huge, Advancing the Science of Cancer in Latinos, I came across this term multiple times, the Latino paradox. And can you talk about that, Amelie?
Yeah, so the Latino paradox, it's even though we tend to have less health insurance, we tend to have, you know, lower education rates and lower socioeconomic status, that we don't necessarily have more disease. And so that's the paradox, is normally these social determinants would put you in a trajectory of having a higher rate for certain diseases. But the most common cancers of prostate and breast are a little bit lower in the Latino community. Mortality is a different story.
See, that's the nugget of really what I want to get at. So those cancers occur less often in the Latino population, but they tend to be more frequently fatal because of lack of early detection, lack of access to treatment.
That's correct. That's correct. And so that's why we really need to get folks in early to say, you know, you can fight this. cancer if you're diagnosed early. But there are certain cancers that, you know, the symptoms, right, mimic other things, and so that might delay people from coming in. But what we have observed, mainly the main barrier is, I don't have insurance. How am I going to pay for this? Cancer is becoming a costly disease because of some of the treatments. I understand what Julia and the other caller was mentioning, and so that we do need to find out how we can reduce the cost for some of these concerns. But most of all, if you can come in for screening, that's the best thing you can do.
Right. So, Dr. Kate Lathrop, maybe you can help me understand this, because I understand that there's talk about personalized medicine. That's the future of medicine, and actually getting like very direct genetic makeup of an individual. Of course, this is right now science fiction. It's not real, but this is where we're headed, right? And whether or not that is something that everyone is going to be able to benefit from. Is that, what's your reaction to that?
Sure. I think in specifically cancer care is where I'll speak. There are some very direct therapies based on genetic mutations in the tumor cells themselves, not so much the DNA that you inherited from your parents and pass on, but the genetic makeup of the tumor. So there are multiple therapies that we use based on the genetic makeup. And we can even detect changes in our metastatic patients through circulating tumor cells in the blood that we can sequence the DNA on those tumor cells. So partly some of this is almost science fiction, but it's really starting to filter down into the clinic and certain patient populations. But it's not so much the DNA that you inherit and pass on to your children, like you would with a BRCA mutation, but it's more the mutations in the tumor cells themselves that we're targeting. There are medicines specifically for BRCA mutated patients, and that would probably be the best example of a medicine that's directed specifically to that. But again, we're probably missing some of those mutation carriers in Hispanic patients.
Because we don't have enough samples or tumors?
Right. So the way this works is they put hundreds and hundreds and thousands of women's DNA into databases, and then they match that with their clinical data. So who got cancer and who didn't? And in order for us to find those genes, that one grain of sand on the beach that increases the risk of developing cancer, we have to have a big sample size to find that gene. And if those patients' DNA sequencing data are not included in the databases, that abnormal gene may not filter up to the top so that we can see that it really is concerning and that we need to either screen that woman differently, potentially offer them prophylactic surgeries if that's something they're interested in, and potentially treat them differently if they do develop breast cancer.
And so, Amelie Ramirez, do we need more Latinos to participate in clinical trials?
We definitely do, David. I was going to say some of the national databases that Dr. Lathrop was referring to, we don't have that good diversity. And sometimes some of the pharmaceutical companies that are trying out these new drugs, they're going to places such as China because it's easier to recruit people and test them. So we do not have the representation of the U.S. population. And if we do, it tends to be more non-Hispanic, white representation and very underrepresented.
Well, we have trials here in San Antonio.
We have trials here
absolutely.
In San Antonio.
Yeah. We have hundreds of clinical trials that are available in San Antonio for all different tumor types and all different stages. I think one of the misconceptions is that a clinical trial is just your last-ditch effort. That's what we do when you don't have any standard therapy left for you. We have clinical trials on prevention all the way through the metastatic disease. We have weight loss trials. We have lifestyle trials. We almost have a trial for anybody. So there's lots of different opportunities. And if you're interested in seeing if there's a clinical trial available to you, there's clinicaltrials.gov, which is national. There's the Mays Cancer Center website, which can give you local trials at our cancer center, or the phone number is 210-450-1000.
All right. I want to thank you, Dr. Kate Lathrop, Assistant Professor of Hematology Oncology at UT Health San Antonio. Also with us on the phone, we're joined by Julia Moss, a patient advocate, and Amelie Ramirez, a doctor of health sciences at the UT Health San Antonio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Ken Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.